Good, we're on page 726. We're starting a new Sefer, new book, the fourth book of the Torah, Parshas Bamidbar, Sefer Bamidbar. Chazal tell us that La'olam, we always read Parshas Bamidbar before Shavuos. Right? That's the way the laning is structured, that we always read Parshas Bamidbar before Shavuos. Most times, the Parshas Bamidbar is the Shabbos directly before Shavuos. There are years where there's another one before Shavuos, Parshas Nasai, but the idea is that Parshas Bamidbar should always come before Shavuos, just like Nitzavim should always come before Rosh Hashanah. Now the simple halachic reason that's given for this is because it's not so much to do with Parshas Bamidbar, it's got to do with what came before Bamidbar. That in Parshas B'chukosai last week, as well as Parshas Kisovai, which is 2 weeks before Rosh Hashanah, there's the Parsha where we read the curses. Right? And we don't want to go straight from the curses into Rosh Hashanah or into Shavuos. Shavuos is a very important day. Shavuos is a Rosh Hashanah of sorts. It says it's like the Rosh Hashanah of Torah and other things. So we don't want to go straight from reading the curses straight into Shavuos, or straight from the curses in Parshas Kisovai straight into Rosh Hashanah. So we make a break with another Parsha. So before Shavuos we break with Parshas Bamidbar, and before Rosh Hashanah we break with Parshas Nitzavim. However, the Mefarshim point out that that's only a reason on one level, but the fact that we do read Parshas Bamidbar before Shavuos means that there's got to be some hint to the whole concept of Matan Torah and the giving of the Torah in Parshas Bamidbar itself. It cannot be that it's just to interrupt between last week and Shavuos. There must be some direct connection between this Parsha and Shavuos. And of course, the connection here is obvious because we know that the Torah was given Bamidbar. Torah was given in a desert, right? With tremendous emphasis. It was dafka given in a desert. Why was it given in a desert? Why was the Torah given in a desert? Because the desert symbolizes many things. First of all, the desert symbolizes the fact that it's ownerless. Alpi halacha, if you find something in an inhabited area, so there's a mitzvah in the Torah called Hashava Savevi. You have to give it back. You have to look for the owner. Okay, certain circumstances you can't find an owner, so you can keep it. But generally speaking, if you find something in a midbar, in a desert, right, it says that it's ownerless, it's hefker. It has no owner. If it's someone dropped it, they've given up hope. They're not going to find it in a desert. So therefore, anything you find in a desert sort of is up for keeps. You can keep it, it's yours. And that's one of the reasons that the Torah was given in a midbar, because to emphasize the fact that the Torah is ownerless. The Torah doesn't belong to any particular group, doesn't belong to any particular level of a person. Any yid can get the Torah. Any yid can acquire Torah. Different to some of the other things. For example, we have the idea of kahuna, of priesthood, which is specifically belongs to the Kohanim. Malchus, kingdom, which specifically belongs primarily to the dynasty of David HaMelech. But Torah belongs to everyone. And that's why it was given in the Midbar. Another reason why it's given in the Midbar is because a midbar, a desert, represents humility. It's a place where nothing grows. It's just ground where you tread on. So it symbolizes the concept of humility. And of course, a prerequisite to Torah study and acquiring the Torah is in fact humility. And that's one of the reasons given in midbar. And that, of course, is the connection between this parsha and Shavuos, because this parsha is called by midbar, and it's read before Shavuos because the Torah was given in a midbar. Right? Just on that topic, before we go to the actual parsha, there's a famous medrash, and the medrash says that the Torah was given with three things: ba'esh, with fire; ba'mayim, with water. That goes, I guess, that's got to do with the Kriyas Yamsuf from the coming to the Torah through the Red Sea; ba'midbar, in the desert. Right, and there's many explanations of what that represents. One of the explanations is that again, to emphasize that the Torah applies to all people, all situations, all times. Fire rises. So fire, it says, represents a person in a successful situation. A person who's on top, a person that's always growing. Mayim, water, on the other hand, is something that comes from above to below. It comes down. So that represents a person who's going downhill, who's downtrodden. Right? So we say that, and of course, Midbar, again, the concept of a desert means that it's ownerless. This idea that Torah is there for everyone, Torah has to be, not only it's available for everyone, but it's obligatory for everyone to actually avail themselves of the Torah. Like the Gemara tells a famous story, the Gemara says that Rabbi Lazar ben Hyrcanus will be the one to obligate the rich, and Hillel will be the one to obligate the poor. What does that mean? So the Gemara says Rabbi Lazar ben Hyrcanus was incredibly wealthy, and yet he didn't use an excuse that he's too busy with business meetings or business affairs to not study Torah. He became one of the greatest Tanoim, and he was a great Tanoim. Notwithstanding, and the Torah, and the Gemara describes his wealth and what he owned cities and ships and all kinds of things. Hillel, on the other hand, was poverty-stricken, and that's all sometimes an excuse that people have, because poverty-stricken people obviously are very distracted and it's very difficult to focus. And Hillel, of course, is the famous story how he had mysterious nefesh, he even climbed on a roof to hear a shir, the whole story the Gemara tells. Right? So the Gemara says that Hillel will obligate those that are poverty-stricken. So that's the concept, that the Torah is there for every single person, every single time. It's timeless, it's personless, it's hefker, it's available and obligatory for everyone to connect to the Torah on some level. Incidentally, just while we're on that topic, that's also is a famous idea. I'm sure we mentioned this many times already, but coming up to Shavuos, it's a worthwhile mention, that Shavuos is a very interesting yontif. Shavuos is the yontif where we commemorate the giving of the Torah. The Torah, giving of the Torah at Har Sinai, of course, is the, I could say, the greatest event, the greatest experience that ever happened to the Jewish people. It was the event that defined us as a nation. It's the one-off event that says Matan Torah never happened, never will happen again. It's a one-time thing. It was an incredible exposure to God, to the Torah. On all levels, it was the most amazing event. Yet, we have a dispute in the Gemara of when it actually happened. Right? There's a famous dispute in the Gemara whether it happened on the 6th of Sivan or the 7th of Sivan. And it's an unresolved dispute. And it's an amazing thing. I mean, we know when the Jews left Mitzrayim, what date it was. We know when other events happened. We know when Purim happened, Hanukkah happened. Yet the most amazing event of all times, the event of Matan Torah, we're actually not sure when it happens. In fact, it's interesting, the whole Yom Tov of Shavuot is actually not connected to a date. The Gemara says that even if you would know when it happened, actually it's nothing to do with the Yom Tov of Shavuot. Yom Tov of Shavuot is a Yom Tov which comes on the 50th day of the Omer. You count 49 days and you keep Shavuos. It has nothing to do with the date. In fact, in the times of the Beis HaMikdash, when they would establish the month or the length of the month on a month-by-month basis, and some months had 29 days and some months had 30 days, and that could vary from month to month, Shavuos had three options. It could actually come out on the 5th of Sivan, the 6th of Sivan, or the 7th of Sivan. Right? Because if both Nisan and Iyar had 30 days, then it would be brought forward. It would be on the 5th of Sivan. They both had 29 days, it would be the 7th of Sivan. If it's like nowadays, the one has 30, one has 29, it would be the 6th of Sivan. Right? So the whole Shavuos, it's interesting. We don't know when Matan Torah happened. Shavuos itself has no date. It's like a very, very strange and unique type of yontif and type of idea that we don't know when this actually happened. And then one of the reasons it's given is because this HaKadosh Baruch Hu especially allowed that to happen because he didn't want us to ascribe Matan Torah to a particular date. He wanted us to emphasize that concept that it's above any date. It's nothing to do with any time. It's not restricted to a specific time. Yes, of course, there's the anniversary of the Torah. There's the commemoration of the Yom Tov that we commemorate on Shavuos. But essentially, it's not connected to any time. And that reflects in the fact that it's not connected to a date. We don't even know when it happened, etc. Okay. Good. So that's just a little bit about Shavuos. Incidentally, in case I forget, at the end of the shir, just good time to remind now. Next Tuesday is Erev Shavuos. I'm actually not going to give the shir. It's Erev Yontif. But instead, on Monday, instead of my wife's Chumash shir, I'm going to give a shir especially on Shavuos. So Monday at 10 o'clock, for those that can make it. So Tuesday's Erev Yontif is not conducive, but I'll do a special one on Shavuos on Monday morning at 10 o'clock. Okay. Let's have a look at some of the sukkim of Parshas Bamidbar. Let's start from the beginning. Vaydaber Hashem Moshe Bamidbar Sinai. Hashem spoke to Moshe Rabbeinu in the Midbar Sinai. Be'oil Moed, he spoke to him from the Mishkan. Be'echad L'chodesh Sheni, on the first of the second month, which is the first of Iyar. Bashana Hasheni, this was the second year. Let's say some Eretz Mitzrayim Leimor, from the going out of Mitzrayim, saying, What did he tell him to do? He told him, Sa'u Esroish Kladas V'nei Yisrael, count the Jewish people. It was one of the times that there was a commandment to count the Jewish nation. Mishpachosim, Veisavosim, count their families, their father's houses, etc. Mispar Shemois, we should know exactly the number of the names, called Zachar L'Bulgaloisim, all males, count their heads, Miben Esrim Shana V'mala, from 20 years old, Kol Yoyitz Tov V'Yisrael, those that are fit to go to the army, Tiftgu Oisim, Esivosim Atav Aaron, you should count them with all the hosts, you and Aaron. V'itchem Yiyu, and with you shall be Ish Ish L'Mateh, there shall be a person with you to help you out, Ish Reloisim V'Yisav V'Yisavu, each person is the head of his tribe, and the Torah goes on to enumerate the head of each tribe that conducted the survey, the census, together with Moshe and Aaron. Right?
Are these the same guys who were the spies later on?
No. Different. Might have been some of the. I don't think so. No. No. You see, because these were the leaders of the tribes. These were the tribes weren't the spies. I don't see if any of them are the same. I don't think so. No. They weren't the same. Pretty sure, huh?
For Judah here it's Nachshon, and then the Menadav, and in here it's Judah.
No, they're all different. Ephraim is different. Yeah, they're all different. Those weren't the heads of the tribes. Those were just people handpicked from each tribe. That's all. These were the leaders of each tribe, and they had to assist Moshe and Aaron. Okay, so first of all, just before we go into a little bit to understand what this is all about, so we know that counting is an interesting thing. We know on the one hand, we're actually not permitted to count people, which is actually why the census that was done in the desert, this one and the previous ones, this is more sort of explained in Parashat Kisiso, but nevertheless, the concept is the same, that actually it wasn't done by counting the people, it was done by counting half shkolim. So each person had to give a half a shekel, and then it was counted that way. Right, you know, there's an issur, there's a prohibition to count people, which exists even today. It's important to know. If you want to know how many people are in a room, we don't count people. We don't say 1, 2, 3. There's different ways of doing it. Either there's in a shul, if you need a minyan, you always use a pasuk. There's a pasuk that they use: Hashir esamecha varach esnachal asecha ureim v'nasem ad ha'olam. The reason they use that is because it's got 10 words. Mm-hmm. Right, so you count people. Hashir esamecha. Or there's another way, traditionally in Yiddish they say, not one, nicht eins, nicht zwei, not one, not two, not three. What's that?
Nicht eins, nicht zwei.
Nicht eins, zwei, right, because that's the idea, because you don't count people, it's an ein hara, you don't want to single out people. Okay. On the other hand, there's a mitzvah to count them in the Torah, because, and we'll see why in a second. The Torah says in Parashat Kisisa that you should not count them, because if you count them, there could be a plague. In fact, there was a story in the time of David HaMelech where he did count them because he thought that there was only a commandment that applies to the Chumash times, and in fact there was a plague, and it was a terrible thing. And it's such a strict thing that the Gemara goes to such an extent, we find in Mishnah Yuma, that even when there's a counting to be done, not to count to know how many people there are, but just sort of a counting that was done in a different context, you also have to be very careful. For example, in the Beis HaMikdash every day, there was a group of Kohanim that used to serve in the Beis HaMikdash, right? So the way it was is the Kohanim were divided into 24 groups. Each week had their own group. Each day had their subgroup. And so therefore, many, many Kohanim presented every day in the Beis HaMikdash to do the service. But yet, not every Kohen could get everything. So they need to be a sort of a lottery system where to pick the various Kohanim to do the various services during the day in the Beis HaMikdash. So there was various systems of how it was done. One of the systems that was done in the Beis HaMikdash was like a raffle system that worked in the following way. The head kohen, or the kohen in charge, would get everyone into a circle, and he would start with one person, and he would pick a number. And the idea was, he would just start counting that number around and around, and the kohen who he ended the number with would be the kohen chosen for that particular avodah, whether it was to bring the ketores, the incense, or to clear the ash of the mizbeach, whatever the case was. But the Mishnah tells us he didn't actually count them. Because even though he wasn't really counting him to know the number, he was just counting him for a lottery system, but nevertheless it's still counting, so they actually used to put out their fingers, and he would count the fingers, he wouldn't count them. Instead, he was actually counting their fingers, he wouldn't be actually counting them, because it's all part of this prohibition of counting people. So much so that the Gemara had to say that a Kohen could put out any finger, but they weren't allowed to put out their small finger or their thumb. Why? Because there was a story once that happened that the Kohen was so eager to do the Avodah, to do the service of the Mesa Mikdash, and he saw the number coming to a close near him, and he made a quick calculation, and he saw that it's going to end with the Kohen next to him, and not him. So he put out two fingers to sort of create the impression that he was two people, and then they're there. So anyway, they made a thing that has to be fair, so he's going to put out a finger that he can't create a false impression. Okay. So I'm just bringing that in, so it shows you that this idea of counting people is a very important thing, that we don't count people for whatever purposes it is. It's such a shaila, I'm not going to go into it now because I haven't researched it for a while, but there's even a shaila where the one is permitted in Israel to participate in the census. In Australia it's not a problem because it's not done by non-Jews and the majority of people are non-Jews, but in Israel it's all Jews and it's Jews doing the counting, where a census creates a problem of counting people. At the end of the many, many poskim that say it's okay, because it's necessary for military purposes, security purposes, and it's not really considered counting, and there's other people involved.
But it's again, you're not counting the people, it's counting all of
you. Oh, so some people say it's not actually counting
the
people. Yeah, but you're doing it to know how many people there are, so that's right, so that could be another thing, you're not actually counting the forms. So, and if I'm just highlighting it, the shaila is brought up, so it's interesting that this idea of not counting people has various different ramifications and could affect the different areas of halacha. Okay, what's the purpose of counting people? So let's see Rashi over here. Let's see what Rashi says. Rashi mentions an interesting thing. He says, "Mitoich chibosan lefanov," because of the love that Hashem has for the Jewish people, because of the love that exists between the Jew and Hashem, "Moina oisam kol shaha," he counts them all the time. Kol shaha means all the time. And Rashi specifies, "Kishyotzim in Mitzrayim," when he counted them, when they went out of Mitzrayim, "Monon," he counted them. "Ukishanofal be'egel," when they fell in the Egel Hazov, in the golden calf, and just before they were about to build the Mishkan, "Monon," he counted them again. "Lei daminyan hanisrayim," to know who was left. "Kishabola hashrash chinose aleim," and then when he wanted to actually rest his Shechina upon them. In other words, when the Shechina was complete, when the Mishkan was complete, and the Divine Presence had rested in amongst the Jewish nation, once again, monam, he counted them. How do we see it? This is the census. That be'echad b'nissan hukam ha-mishkan, on the first of Nisan, the Mishkan was established. U'be'echad b'iyar monam, and the census took place on the first of Iyar. So in other words, the census was a connection to the establishment of the Mishkan. Okay. Now there are a number of questions on this whole thing. First of all, what does it mean that because Hashem has the love that exists between Hashem and the Jewish nation, He counts them all the time? I mean, He knows how many we are. Right? It's not like we count something we don't know how many there are. So, you know, if you're taking care of the... I know when I was young, I was a counseling camp. I hated it. But one of the reasons I hated it is because we used to take the kids on excursions. I was like neurotic. I was always scared I was going to lose the kid. So I probably used to count them. Of course, I would do the pasuk and not one and not two and all that. But I count them every 3 minutes, like just to know that I haven't lost anyone. Right? Yeah, I gave it up pretty quickly. It wasn't for me. So that's what people count things. They count things because either you're worried about something or you love something. So most people count their money. Why? Because they want to see how much they have, right? But when it comes to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it doesn't make sense, this concept. What does it mean He loves them, He counts the Jewish people? He knows how many we are. He doesn't have to count. He doesn't need us to count ourselves so He can know how many we are, sort of thing. So what does it actually, we need to understand what it really means that He counts. Second of all, we have a little bit of a problem because Rashi says that He counted them here in connection with the establishment of the Mishkan. But this happened a month later. Right? He put up the Mishkan. The Mishkan was ready and established and dedicated and inaugurated on the first of Nisan. And so He counted them on the first of Iyar. That doesn't seem that much connected with the counting, with the establishment of the Mishkan, right? Okay, you could say that the day that the Mishkan was established was a busy day. There were lots of things happening that day. So therefore it needed to be done the next day. So could it be done the second of Nisan? Third of Nisan. Why the first of Iyar? All right. Rabbi Yonatan Eibeshitz explains, Rabbi Zalman Suratskin explains, one of the Mefarshim, he says that maybe because the word's different, the word, Hashem wanted to count them on the first of the month. Just like the Mishkan was established on the first of the month, and for all sorts of reasons, we say the first of Nisan was a very special day, many things happened on the first of Nisan, so Hashem wanted, in connection with the Mishkan, also to count them on the first of the month, because the Mishkan was established the first of the month, but the first of Nisan was too busy, so therefore he counted them the first of, but when I say too busy, I don't mean that God was too busy, I mean, he wanted us to do the counting, right? So obviously we were too busy. Yeah. So he wanted the counting to happen the first of the year. Okay, that's one possible answer. So, but we still have to understand, what does it really mean? Why was the first of the year, right? And why does Hashem count us all the time? The third thing we have to understand is, interesting, why is it that this time Aaron was part of the process? Not only Aaron, but all the heads of the tribes. It appears if you look at the census before, Moshe Rabbeinu was told to administer a census among the Jewish nation. But here there's all of a sudden an emphasis that Aaron should be with it, and also the heads of the tribes. So why is that? So I'll share with you a concept that the Lubavitch Rebbe once explained on this whole concept of counting. Then we can answer these various questions. And explains like this. When you count someone, what is the idea of counting someone? Counting people means that everyone is the same. In other words, counting emphasizes not the difference between people, but the equality between people. Follow? Because every person only gets one number. Every person only worth one. Doesn't matter what kind of person it is. Right? So the idea of counting people and numbering how many people there are emphasizes that everyone is worth one. Now, is everyone equal? So we know that that's not actually true. We know everyone's different. Everyone is different because everyone has unique talents. Everyone has a unique way of thinking. Everyone has a different... I mean, the Gemara says... Ain parts the same shavos, the people's faces are not the same, people's perspectives are not the same, everyone is different, right? Everyone has a different shtempel, as I say. So at what level actually are we all the same? There is one level where we are all the same. And that's a concept that we've spoken about many times, and that what we call the etzem ha-neshama, the yechida, the pintel yid, right? The very essence of the neshama, right? We explained this last Thursday, we explained it many, many times, that a person operates on many levels. Essentially, the Medrash says there are five levels of the neshama. Four of those levels relate to how we function. So that's the level of behavior, and there's a level of midas, of emotion, the level of seichel, the level of intellect, the level of the subconscious. On those levels, taka, everyone is different. Everyone thinks differently, everyone feels differently, everyone reacts differently, everyone behaves differently, everyone has different abilities, everyone has different weaknesses, different strengths, etc. But at the fifth level of the neshama, the very essence of the neshama, the part of the neshama that is inseparable from HaKadosh Baruch Hu and can never be damaged or corrupted, at that level, taka, every yid is exactly the same. So what is the concept of counting? The concept and the reason why HaKadosh Baruch Hu counted us, not because he needs to know our number. The reason why HaKadosh Baruch Hu counts us is because he wants that level of the neshama to be emphasized. He wants that level of the neshama to be revealed. Because what happens most of the time and with most people, although every person possesses that level of the neshama where everyone's the same, everyone possesses that level, that spark of the neshama where everyone is, where we are completely one with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, nevertheless, that level of the neshama is normally hidden. It's normally deep, deep in the recesses of our neshama, completely hidden from other people and especially from ourselves. Right? The purpose, of course, is to try and reveal that part of the neshama, to try and reveal the essential connection that we have with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that's the idea of counting. Counting highlights the sameness between people, i.e., counting highlights and reveals that level of the neshama, where we're all the same, and it brings it out into the open. Okay. However, there are different ways that the revelation of the etzem ha-neshama can take place. And we find this in all different ways. Right? What's the idea? The idea is like this. Obviously, when we behave every day, when we function every day, we're not functioning at the level of our pintel yid. We're functioning on functional levels. We're functioning with our emotions, with our feelings, with our behavior. Right? But there are sometimes, for example, like there were stories throughout Jewish history, where there were people who did not serve Hashem at all on the other levels of the neshama. And yet, when they were challenged, they gave up their life for Hashem. Right? I've told you many times the story of Yossele the Gunner, right? Okay, you all know what I'm talking about? Where there was a tombstone that said that over here lies Yassala the Ganef, Zeicha Tzadik Livracha, blessed memory. Right? The story was because he was talking Ganef and then he got caught, but he was given the challenge that even he converts or he throws into the fire, jumps to the fire, and he jumped into the fire and said Shema Yisrael. So he jumped into the fire, he said Shema Yisrael, so he was died at Tzadik, a Kaddish, but he was always called Yassala the Ganef, that's what he was, that's what his essence was, he was a gangster. Let's analyze that for a moment. When he jumped into the fire, what actually happened? What actually happened when he jumped into the fire? What happened was, his essence of his neshama became revealed. Right? Did it change him? Did he become a different person? No. He didn't become a different person. His way of thinking wasn't any different. His behavior wouldn't have been any different. Had he been kept alive, he probably would have gone back the next day to his regular job, thieving, not stealing. At that moment, his neshama was revealed, the pintali, the fifth level of the neshama was revealed. What happens is, when the fifth level of the neshama is revealed, it anethetizes and totally pushes aside any other level of the neshama. So for a moment, all levels of the neshama did not change, but they ceased to function. They ceased to manifest themselves, and he was only operating at the level of the fifth level of the neshama, and he jumped into the fire. But essentially, he didn't change. His seichel, his level, his way of thinking didn't change. His emotions didn't change. His feelings didn't change. Nothing changed. That's one way that the fifth level of the neshama can be revealed. However, sometimes a person can get some sort of very, very strong inspiration where the fifth level of the neshama is revealed, but it actually has an effect on all the other levels as well. Right? Sometimes, for example, a person can hear something very, very inspiring. Something can trigger. He can be all of a sudden aroused to do tshuva, and he does tshuva, and it lasts for a few weeks. It lasts how he behaves, how he feels. Attacker has an effect on his daily routine. In other words, it's having an effect on the other levels of the neshama as well. But then after a few weeks, it seems to disappear. Why? What happened? What happened at that level is that the fifth level of the neshama didn't just anethetize everything else. It had an effect on the other levels of the neshama as well, but it was an imposed change. In other words, the thinking, the emotion of the person didn't essentially change. For a while, it took on the persona, the personality, the identity of the essence of the neshama. It wasn't anethetized, didn't go to sleep. It continued to function under the influence of the essence of the neshama, but it didn't essentially change. In other words, it was like an imposed change. It's like someone was sort of invading. It was like the other levels of the neshama being invaded by the essence of the neshama and therefore functioning like that. After a while, that wears off, and because the thinking and the emotions of the person doesn't essentially change, so they go back to their old behavior. The ultimate level, of course, is that no, when a person becomes inspired, when the fifth level of the neshama is triggered, that the person themselves should change. That it should have such an effect on the other levels of the neshama that the neshama itself should actually intrinsically change and become different. That the seichel, the thinking of the person should become a different thinking, the emotion should become a different emotion, the behavior should become a different behavior. And when the person changes from within, not by being imposed change, but really from within changing every single part of the levels of the neshama, that's how you have sustainable change, and that's how the change actually permanently lasts. Okay. So those are the three effects that the revelation of the fifth level of the neshama can have another person. So he explains that's essentially what the three countings were that Rashi talks about over here. Right. First counting is the idea of revealing the essence of the neshama, the sameness, the equality that exists between people. The first one was when the Jews left Mitzrayim. When the Jews left Mitzrayim, we know that they were spiritually impure. When the Jews left Mitzrayim and became spiritually pure, spiritually free, they themselves weren't changed at all. This was even pre-counting the Omer. They weren't changed whatsoever. It was a total just explosion of the essence of the neshama. They left Mitzrayim, everything else was just gone by the wayside, everything else was anethetized, nothing actually essentially changed, it was just the neshama working at its very, very fundamental level. And that's the first counting. That's the level where the essence of the neshama reveals itself like with Yassil and the Ganef, but the Ganef doesn't change. It's just that the essence of the neshama is revealed, and that's how the Jews left Mitzrayim. That's the first counting. What happens after that, essentially? What does that counting lead to eventually? What actually happened eventually? They sinned with the golden calf. because they themselves never changed. Even with the Omer, and even with Matan Torah, they themselves never changed, and eventually it led to the sin of the golden calf. They were able to fail because they were never intrinsically changed. So then HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes and says, no, let me show you how it has to happen. Here comes the second counting. The second counting is going to allow you to build a Mishkan. After the Egel Azal, Hashem says, let's count you again. Let's show you how the revelation of the essence of the Neshama can now have an effect on every other part of your personality and allow you to create a Mishkan. A Mishkan means a place where you make yourselves a dwelling place for Hashem. You make your own personality a place where Hashem can rest. Every single part of you, not just the Pintalid, not just the essence of the Neshama. And that's the second counting, and that brought eventually to putting up the Mishkan on the first of Nisan. But then Hashem says there has to be a third counting. Because that second counting, where the revelation of the Etzem HaNeshama allowed change to take place on all levels of the Neshama, but that has to happen in two stages. The first stage is where it's an imposed change. And there's a Mishkan. Suddenly there's a Mishkan. It's an imposed change. But now Hashem says there has to be a third counting. And the third counting is, you have to start changing. You, from yourself, within yourself, you have to make that change so that it's not an imposed change anymore, it's a real change, it's an intrinsic change. And that's the third counting. And that's why the third counting takes place specifically on the first of Iyar, and Aaron was part of the process, Aaron and the tribes of the Jewish nation. Why? What's the difference between Nisan and Iyar? So we know that the difference between Nisan and Iyar is that Nisan represents that imposed change from above, because Nisan is the month of revelation, it's the month where Hashem took us out of Mitzrayim. Iyar is the month where we count the Omer and we work with ourselves. So Iyar represents change from with us, change from within. And that's why the third counting, which represents that ultimate sustainable change, happens in the month of Iyar. Similarly, that's why Aaron and the tribes were part of the process, because in Zohar it says that Moshe and Aaron were like unteferers by a wedding. You know, like by a wedding you have unteferers. Right, the chasa and the kala, the people that go with the chasa, the people that go with the kala. So it says that when we got the Torah, it was like a wedding between Hashem and the Jewish nation. And just like every wedding, you have unteferers, so therefore we have unteferers also. Moshe Rabbeinu was the unteferer of Hashem, and Aaron was the unteferer of the Yidden. That's what it says. It's called shushvinim in Hebrew. So it says that Moshe Rabbeinu was shushvina de malka, the unteferer of the king, and Aaron was the shushvina, the unteferer of the queen, meaning the Jewish people, right? In other words, Moshe Rabbeinu brought the Torah to us. Aaron is about elevating us towards the Torah. So that's why he's about us changing. Not just having impulse change from the outside or from the essence of the Neshama, but us refining ourselves and becoming in sync with the intensity of the Etzem HaNeshama. And that's why Aaron was part, and that's why also the tribes of the Jewish nation were part of the whole process. Because that change has to come from the people. Change has to come from us. Has to be permanent and sustainable change. So that's the pshat in the three countings. That's the purpose of the counting. And that's why we have three counting, because it's three levels of how that sameness, that root of the Neshama, the essence of the Neshama, is actually revealed throughout the Jewish people. That's a little bit about the concept of counting. Okay, let's go further. I just realized that for the next part, I actually wanted to show you a diagram. So we'll just ask them to make a copy. Give me 1 second.
How many grandchildren she's got? She wouldn't answer me. So is that wrong?
Okay.
Is it wrong to ask somebody how many grandchildren they've got? Is it wrong?
Oh, that's a different thing. Some people. That's a good question.
I ask somebody how many grandchildren she wouldn't answer.
Yeah, no, there's some people that don't do that. It's a conservation horror. It comes from the same idea.
Yeah.
You don't want to sort of emphasize a number. Some people that won't say how many kids they have, they won't say how many grandchildren they have.
Okay.
Yeah. Some people say it, but they say Ken and Hora, that's what they say. Right?
Yeah.
Okay, the next part of the parasha is a very interesting part. I think we touched on part of it last year, but we'll try and do it a little bit different this year. I'll show you where it is. Go to page 732. Yeah, when I was at 732. I need to get more commotion, sorry. Thank you so much. Okay, we just want to close the door, please. You know what I mean? Just pass this around if you don't mind. Yeah. The next part of the parsha describes the command of Hashem to Moshe Rabbeinu, okay, of how exactly the Jewish people should camp in the desert. Okay. Let's have a look at the Psukim, it's Perek Bay's second chapter. It says the following. Vayidaber Hashem Moshe vel Aaron Neymar. And Hashem spoke to Moshe and Aaron saying, Ish al digloi, each man on his flag, the oisois levesa vesam, the signs for their father's house, yachanu b'nei Yisrael, should camp, that's how Jewish people should camp, mineget soviv l'oil moed yachanu, corresponding and around the oil moed the Mishkan. Okay. What happened was as follows, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu instructed that the Jewish people should camp in four groups called four the Golem, four flags. Right? Meaning it was 12 tribes. 12 tribes divided into four. And each those four groups became known as the Degel, the flag. And each Degel had three tribes, right? If you have a look at the diagram that you have in front, right? The way it worked was like this, just so you get a bit of an idea. You had the Mishkan in the middle. Right? The Mishkan, when they arrived at a destination, how they traveled, by the way, is a dispute. Some people say they traveled like this as well. Some people say they traveled in a straight line. Okay, but let's talk about when they didn't travel. So when they arrived at a destination, they set themselves up like this. The Mishkan was in the middle. Around the Mishkan were four groups of Levim, the tribe of Levi. You see that to the east was Moshe, Aaron, and his sons. Then there was the three sons of Levi, Gershon, Kohos, and Merari. Merari is at the north, Gershon at the west, Kohos in the south. Okay? And then you've got four Degalim. So you have the Degel of Yehuda to the east, the Degel of Reuven to the south, the Degel of Binyamin to the west, and the Degel of Dan to the north. And then you have the corners that you say that was the way where they kept the animals, right? So they like in a square or a rectangle. Now, this was very, very specific, and it was considered very, very important exactly how the Jewish people should camp. The Medrash tells us that what actually happened, how did this all happen? We'll come back to this in a minute. It happened because when HaKadosh Baruch Hu came to reveal himself at Har Sinai, it's got to do with Matan Torah as well. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu descended upon the mountain at Har Sinai to reveal himself and give us the Torah, so it says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Shekhinah, the Divine Presence, revealed Himself in Har Sinai, surrounded by thousands of camps of angels. And it says what happened was that the Jewish people who were exposed to this vision, they saw the Divine Presence in the middle. The Divine Presence, the Shekhinah, was surrounded by 22,000 malachim, 22,000 inner angels, which were then surrounded by tens of thousands of angels. So there was like three circles. There was Hashem in the middle, so to speak, one circle of 22,000 angels, and then tens of thousands of angels surrounding that. And they were divided into the inner circle and the outer circle were divided into four camps, four groups. And it says that when the Jewish people saw that, they had this incredible desire to camp like that. They had this incredible desire to be structured, that their camping should emulate the way it was. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it says, granted their request. Right, he granted their request. And that's why you have the camping of the Jewish people like this, that the Mishkan's in the middle, right? The Mishkan's in the middle, which represents the Shekhinah, that was like Hashem in the middle at Har Sinai. The inner circle, which is the tribe of Levi, 22,000 of them, which was these four groups of Levim, again, surrounded by the outer circle of all the Jewish people. Now the truth is, this actually went back even before, this had its real origin when Yaakov Avinu passed away. Before Yaakov Avinu died, he instructed his children to take him to Hebron, to Moras HaMachpelah, and he told them exactly how they have to carry his coffin. And he told them to carry it exactly this way. Right? They carried it in four sides. He said that Yosef himself should not carry because he's a king. Levi shouldn't carry because he's going to be the holy tribe. So Levi and Yosef walked behind the coffin, and the 12 sons, the other 11 sons of Yaakov, plus Menashe and Ephraim, who came from Yosef, carried the coffin of Yosef in exactly this way, that Yehuda, Yisachar, and Zvulun were from the front, and etc., all the ones exactly the way it's situated over here. Okay. So So that's where it came, and that's why Hashem revealed himself at Har Sinai, and that's why the Jewish people camped in the desert. Now there's so many midrashim about the significance of how they camped and the colors on their flags and etc. I'm just going to read you one, which actually, if you want to read the rest, just look at the Midrash says. They have a tremendous collection of midrashim on this week's parasha of exactly the significance of each color and each tribe exactly. But I'll just read you a little bit so you understand how this works. First of all, we have the one on the east, right? So the east is the flag of Yehuda. So the Midrash says that Hashem said, Yehuda, which is the tribe that will be the tribe of kings, of Jewish kings, should be the east. Why? The east is the direction of the rising sun. And we know that the Jewish leadership is like a symbol of light. Which is why, with Yehuda came the tribe of Yisachar. Yehuda, Yisachar, and Zevulun always go together. Why? Yehuda is leadership. Yisachar is knowledge, is Torah. It says Yisachar was the tribe that was tremendously knowledgeable in Limud HaTorah and learning of Torah. They were dedicated their whole profession to learning Torah. They were the Yisachar of the Jewish people. They, in fact, it says the Sanhedrin, most of the members of the Sanhedrin always came from the tribe of Yisachar because they were the most knowledgeable tribe. And they always go together with Zevulun because Zevulun was the tribe who undertook to support Yisachar. There was a spiritual partnership between the tribe of Yisachar and the tribe of Zevulun. Zevulun was a business community. They worked, they lived near the port, they had import-export businesses, and they made money, and they shared that with the tribe of Yisachar, who was their neighbor. This happened in Eretz Yisrael, and they partook in their mitzvah, they got a share of their mitzvah. And that's been the basis of the Yisachar-Zevulun partnership. Those that learn Torah and those that support Torah. So that's why they always go together. That's why Yehuda, Yisachar, and Zevulun are in the east. Okay. They were also considered great tzaddikim, by the way. You know, it says from here we also learn about the neighbors of people, right? To have a good neighbor. Yehuda, Yisachar, and Zvulun were very holy tribes, and they were neighbors with Moshe and Aaron. So you see, they had good neighbors that had good influence on them. But we find with the other story of Korach later on in Bamidbar, Korach rebelled, and what happened to Reuven? Most of Korach's rebellion, the 250 people that came with Korach, came from the tribe of Reuven. Who was Korach's neighbor? If you have a look at it, because Korach came from Kohos, so, right? So Reuven was just neighboring and thing, and that's why they went together. So you've got to be careful who your company is. Okay. Yeah. All right. But anyways, the Midrash continues like this: that the south was Reuven. Why? Reuven was a symbol. It says the I don't know what this means exactly, but it says the south is where dew and rain comes from the south. Not sure exactly what that means. But that's what the Midrash says. And that's got to do with Reuven. Why? Because Reuven did tshuva. Reuven taka failed. Reuven wasn't a symbol of purity, like Yisachar and Yehuda. Because you know that Reuven, in the story of the Chumash, Reuven sinned by mixing up the deads and the whole story with Bila and Yaakov. But then we said he did tshuva. Right? So, the Midrash explains like this, that there's holiness and there's strength. You know that rain, for example, is a symbol of strength. And rain comes from the south. Reuven wasn't a symbol of holiness, but Reuven was a symbol of strength. That strength, that inner strength to do tshuva. And that's why Reuven is in the south. Together with God, because God, we says God was a tribe of warriors, soldiers. A lot of the soldiers came from God. So therefore it says that was, again, the symbol of strength, and that comes together with Reuven. Shimon was put there in between Reuven and God. Why? Shimon was always a problematic tribe. Right? I don't know if you know the story. Shimon and Levi were the ones to kill the whole Shechem, but Levi the tshuva after Shimon and Medusa tshuva. Shimon didn't get a bracha from Yaakov. The tribe of Shimon didn't get a bracha from Moshe Rabbeinu either later. Shimon was the problem later on with Pinchas. Shimon was a problematic tribe. They need a lot of spiritual protection. So Hashem sandwiched them in between Reuven and God, the tribes of strength, to be able to be spiritually protected. It didn't always work, obviously, but that was the concept. Okay. Then the message continues about the West. Right? So the West represents, it says, is the permanently from the West comes snow, hail, frost, and heat. The forces, the powerful forces that can cause harm. And that's why it says that Hashem put the children of Yaakov there, of Rachel. If you look at the West, it's the children of Rachel. It's Menashe and Ephraim and Binyamin. Right? Menashe and Ephraim both come from Yosef, and of course Binyamin comes from Rachel, so therefore those are the children of Rachel. Why? Because they're the children of Rachel, who have Rachel's power to defeat those elements of destruction. That's what the Medrash says. And then finally we have Don. Now Don itself, Don was a problematic tribe as well. We know that Don, a lot of problems came from the tribe of Don. Don was considered spiritually the lowest tribe. Don was the tribe that Yerovam ben Nevat came from. Now, Yerovam ben Nevat, the most infamous king in Tanakh, who brought Avodah Zarah, idol worship, the Jewish people came from Don. And that's why it was the north, because the north, it says, the north is the source of the Yetzahara. Right? Mitzofen tipasach haro, says the north is the source of evil. And that's why Don, but next to Don was Osher, because Osher and Naphtali, Osher means light, like Osher, and Don also, and Naphtali means connection, because the idea was that when Don, when you have a tribe of Don, who falls so spiritually low, you need to be connected to Osher and Naphtali to bring you up afterwards and to do tshuva. So I'm just bringing you an example. This is a medrash of different specifics of why different tribes are, and there's much, much more in the medrash. Again, have a look at the medrash, it's fascinating, about the colors of each flag and the colors of each tribe and the whole business. Okay. Let's go back a second over to this concept which we said before, that where did this all come from? It came because when the Yidden saw the Hashem coming down with these camps of the Shekhinah and the camps of the Malachim, they too desired this way of camping, and Hashem gave it to them. What does it actually mean? So just two things. The Sacher Tshuva says, an interesting word. The Sacher Tshuva says like this, the Shem Yishmur. He says, what is a degel? Why do we call them degolim? What is a degel? A degel is a flag, a color, right? What is the idea when people go to war, for example, they have a battalion or you have a camp, and that camp has a different flag, a different color. What does that mean? He says a degel, a camp, a flag, is a symbol, it's like an anchor. In other words, if you move away from the group, or you get lost, or you stray, where do you grab it? How do you return? You return to the banner, you know where your banner is, the sign, right? So the flag, he says, is a symbol of regrouping. It's a symbol of connection. It's a symbol where you come back for protection and you join the rest of the group. In other words, the camp led by this banner, by this color, you can be outside of the camp or you can be back to the camp, right? So he says that when the Yidden saw Matan Torah, they saw camps or flags of angels. What does that mean? They saw an incredible connection that these angels had with Hashem. They saw a dveikus, they saw a bond that existed between these angels and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's the idea, that they saw these flags. They saw similar flags. They saw that each malach, each angel belonged to their flag, to their group. Each malach had their mission. Their mission was clear. There are malachim that serve Hashem out of love. There are malachim that serve Hashem out of fear. Each malach was absolutely clear with his particular group, with his particular mission. And they were part of the group. They were connected to the group. They didn't stray. And they had that incredible connection. And that's what it means that the Yidden desire to camp in that way. In other words, they desire to camp where they would have a connection of clarity with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Where they'd be in a group, they would know what they have to do, their spiritual mission would be clear, and they'd always remain connected to that mission. Why do they have such a desire? Because the Yidden understood that they will not be like the Malachim. The Malachim are able to remain in their group at all times. But a Yid is different. A Yid is a human being. A human being strays. A human being will have sometimes a mission where they have to be involved in the physical impurities of the world, and therefore the Yidden understood that unlike the Malachim, there will be times that they will stray and it will be very difficult to reconnect. Which is why the Yidden had this incredible desire at least to have a frame of reference, at least to have an anchor that they can always return to, at least to have a flag, a sign they can always come back to and always reconnect to. And because they had such a desire to have that connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem said, I'll give it to you. I'll give you that flag, which wasn't only a physical flag with a color. It means I'll give you that ability that even if you stray, you'll always be able to come back to your group. You'll be always able to reconnect and become part of where you're supposed to be and how you're supposed to be. Right? So that's the concept of this desire that the Jewish people had to be able to connect to their flags. But the Mor of Shamish, which is another Pirusham, another commentary on Chumash, he says another verse, another beautiful verse, which I might have mentioned last year, but anyway, it's worth mentioning again. The Maariv HaShamash says the following. He says, what does it mean that the Yidden had such a desire? I mean, why is it so relevant that the Yidden had to camp in this specific way in these groups, just like the malachim. And what will happen if we don't camp like a malachim? I mean, we'll camp a different way. What's so terrible? So he says the following. He says, no, what the Yidden saw was an amazing thing. What does it mean that the Yidden saw the angels camping around Hashem? What does it actually mean? So he says the following. He says that we know that there are two important factors, two important ingredients to serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu, serving Hashem. On the one hand, we know that ambition is very important. Right? A person should always have an incredible ambition to grow, to be different to how we are now. To the point that we have to have very, very high, we have to set the bar very, very high. You know, Chazal tell us that a person is supposed to say, Masai yagiyu maisai lemaisai avoisai avro mitzvah yakov. When can my deeds reach those of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov? Right? That's aiming pretty high. In other words, a person should never say, no, I'm limited, I can't. We have to know we have infinite power. And Hashem is infinite. And Hashem is spiritual, it's divine. Our power is unbelievable. How low we might think we are now, we have to be able to reach and aim incredibly high. Like they say in Yiddish, you have to have grace asogos. You have to have big eyes, right? On the one hand. On the other hand, there's a balance. And the balance is that every person has a particular mission. In other words, that growth that a person has to have, that growth that a person has to aim for, that growth that a person has to experience, to go higher and higher and take quantum leaps and really infinitely grow, but it's all within the context of who you are. Not everyone can be everyone else. A Kohen can't be a Levi can't be Yisrael. A tzaddik can't be a Baal Tshuva can't be a tzaddik, a Rosh Hashiva can't be a businessman can't be a Rosh Hashiva. In other words, everyone has circumstances, everyone has life experiences that have put them in a particular place where they have a particular mission, a particular clarity of where they're supposed to go, a context of how they're supposed to serve Hashem. Everyone serves Hashem differently. Everyone has a place where they're supposed to live, everyone has a mission that they're supposed to embark on, and everyone's mission is different. And the growth that a person has to have has to be with tremendous ambition, but the ambition has to be within their context, not being jealous and not trying to achieve that which is not their mission and that which is the mission of someone else. And the Mor Shamash says, that's what the Yidden saw at Har Sinai. They saw an amazing thing. They saw when HaKadosh Baruch Hu revealed Himself in Har Sinai, they saw these groups of malachim, these groups of angels. What were these groups of angels? Each group of angels was serving Hashem with fire. They were serving Hashem with tremendous kedusha, but they were all sticking to their particular camp. That's what they saw. They saw them. They saw an incredible holiness, but in the context of that particular group. There's a group of Malach Michal that serves Hashem out of love. There's a group of Malach Gavril that serves Hashem out of gevura, out of fear. Malachim weren't envious of each other. Weren't envious of each other's group. They were all serving Hashem with tremendous intensity, but the intensity was only within their own group. And that's what the Yidden desire to achieve. That's an amazing thing. They said, that's an amazing concept. That's an amazing balance. Because if you don't have ambition, okay, so it's not a problem. You're not jealous of someone else. But that's a negative humility. That's a negative lack of jealousy, because that means you're just not growing. Right? What the Yidden desire was to serve Hashem with incredible ambition, with incredible intensity, but at the same time to understand their context and not be jealous of someone else's mission. And they have to be able to stick within their own context. And that's what the desire was when the Yidden saw them camping that way. And that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, okay, I'll give you that ability. I'll show you how to camp around the Mishkan, that your physical camping around the Mishkan will symbolize your mission, will symbolize your tribe, will symbolize your context, and you'll realize and have a reminder always that you need to stick within your context and not be jealous of someone else's. So it's that balance between ambition, but sticking to your context, which is the concept of these flags and these various camps that the Yidden camped in. Good. Stop there. Just a reminder once again, next Tuesday we won't give a shir. But instead, we'll do one on Monday morning at 10 o'clock instead of the Chumash. We'll do a share specifically on Shavuos.